All right, we continue on the questions that we were looking at from Lesson 31, and just want to go through those fairly quickly, I hope. And then, as I mentioned previously, we want to go into Lesson 32, which is another review, but it's, at least it's in your book, so we don't have to come up with off-the-wall questions here. And then we'll start talking about the captivity, Lesson 34, as soon as we get to that. Okay, once again, just to remind us where we are. Here we are in the Western Hemisphere, and of course, we're over here in California. And from here then, at our church building, we are then studying halfway around the world in what we commonly refer to as the Bible lands, and which is nominally these areas here, which include, at least in this particular view right here, Egypt and Israel and other incidental countries. But what we're concerned about is Israel here and Egypt there. Now, once again, when we talk about these things, what normally I say, what's this river right here? But what's this river right here? The Nile. That's right. And it's one of the few, if not the only, river in the world that does what? Flows north. Okay. So, actually, way down here is called the Upper Nile, and down here is called the Lower Nile. And then we have the Nile Delta, and that's essentially the only real habitable portion of Egypt. I mean, you can inhabit along the river here, but it's very, very narrow. If you take a boat down the river, many of the times, you're one bank or the other that you're looking at is just sand, and that's all it does is continue on off sand. That's it. So, very narrow band down here. There's a few areas down for a little further south where you can do something. That's down south here. What do they have that's archaeologically famous? Pyramids. No. Well, there might be pyramids down there, but most of the pyramids are up here. Down south was the Valley of the Kings. So the tomb of Tutankhamun is down there. The temple of Queen Hatshepsut, which is the big long one that you see many times, is sitting back against the cliff. So all those are down there. Interesting thing that also the temple of Luxor is down there, and the temple, every time I say this, the temple of Karnak, I keep thinking of Johnny Carson. But
Luxor, keep thinking Las Vegas.
Yeah, but the interesting thing about it is that all their temples are on the east side of the river, and all of their tombs are on the west side of the river. So the temples are where the sun comes up, and the tombs are where the sun goes down. It's interesting. I didn't know whether or not other cultures did that or not. If you look at cultures of the Indian Southwest, for example, the Navajos point their hogan doors toward the rising sun so that they can greet the rising sun in the morning. The Mayans?
Because they have the pyramids. So.
They had pyramids too. I don't know what their orientation is, or if there is one. You know. Yeah. So. And what did as we get down here and start talking about Israel and Judah being taken away? What did some of the prophets say about the people repenting? They talk about directionality there too. Not that it's as important as we might think that the Muslims consider praying toward Mecca is. But if you'll recall, in a few verses, in some of the prophecies, in some of the discussions about punishment and then coming back, we see that it talks about if you will pray toward Jerusalem and toward this temple and be honest in your prayers, then God will return you to your land. Now, whether that's meant to be physically toward Jerusalem, but what they're saying is that you need to make sure that your prayers are the ones that God wants you to pray, and that you will and eventually then you'll be able to come back home. And eventually they did. One thing as we get into it, and if Mickey's gone for a couple more sessions, we probably get into that. You'll remember that I mentioned in some detail last time about the fact that we have this big old long timeline that we're looking at here, 400 and whatever it was, 56 years or something like that. A long time. And really, it's around twice the length that the United States has been around. And very few of us remember much detail about the early times of the United States. Yet their history is laid out in detail for at least these 400 years, and actually since the beginning of the time of Abram. We see not necessarily a day-by-day account, but we see a constant accounting of where the people of God are and what they're doing at any given and particular time. So, in fact, it's actually probably a 1,000 or a 1,500 years or something like that we have from the time of Abram until the time of the taking away of Judah. But then what's our next subject that we look at after the fall of both kingdoms in our lesson book here? It's the captivity and restoration, right? We have very little story about what goes on in those 70 years. I mean, we have a little bit. We have the book of Esther, and we have the book of Daniel. So we have some mentions here and there, but the fact is that when we look at that and we get to the next book, which is the book of Ezra, we realize that now all of a sudden, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 years later, they're starting to come back to the land that they were promised. And so we've lost track of them. And it turns out, as we get into the book of Ezra, that they also have lost track of themselves. So there are a number of people that claimed, for example, that they were Levites, but they couldn't prove their lineage, and therefore they were not allowed to be in the Levitical priesthood anymore, and so on. And then we see, of course, the fact that people came back to a land that in places was inhabited by the Samaritans, which was a mixed company of the people, the poor people that had been left there 70 or so years ago, and even more than that, and the people that the Assyrians had populated into the land of Israel. So it actually is more than that. When the people of Israel were taken away 135 years, I think it is, before the people of Judah, and the king of Assyria repopulated the land with people from other countries. So for the purpose of making sure that there were no political entities there that had any loyalty to the areas where they were. So those folks have been there for 135-ish years, and then the people go away for another 70 years, and now the land is essentially unpopulated. The Babylonians, did they resettle people into the lands that they conquered? No. They just destroyed the land and then abandoned it. So, unless there was some need for it, of course, but in this instance it wasn't. It was just for them a conduit. Perhaps even for them, it was a buffer between them and who? Egypt, to the south. And Egypt wanted this buffer also between them and the folks up north, both Assyria and Babylon. And so it's an interesting sort of political situation. But we realize, though, that there is a sort of you would call a scattering of the people that were formerly God's people. And we have no real history of them. And when they come back, in many cases, they don't have a history that they can talk about as far as their lineage and their genealogy and stuff like that goes. So that's interesting to note that up until this time, we've been able to follow them day by day, as it were. And now we've kind of lost track of them. They do come back, but they're not the way they were before. All right, so When we look at the area that actually that we're talking about now, we need to zoom out a little bit so that we can realize that this little place, Israel, here is sort of in the middle of the Assyrian and then later on the Babylonian empires that took a lot of this area here in the Fertile Crescent. And so the Bible story now expands, as it were. And we see that actually, up until our time now, the Bible story continues to expand. So that's an interesting thing as we look at it, that the leading of God, of leading by God of His people, and the giving by God of His law to the people is actually expanded to more and more people as we broaden further out here from this little land of Israel. All right, let's just go back to these questions again real quick and see if we can't get them done and then get on to the one that's actually in our book. I think that where we had got last week was the 20. There was one other here that about Huldah. It says, where was that? Because the city is the language is spoken. What is an Israelite? And the name refers to the thing that says, declare the mass throne. Huh. Am I in the right lesson?
Number 20.
Was it 20? Oh, yeah. Who told Josiah that the law was correct? Okay. And it turns out, as I read through the lesson in the lesson, I've had a tendency to get away from the lesson book because we've been looking at things more directly in the biblical text. So I was expecting, as many of you were, for many of these things to be in the text of the Bible, as opposed to just in the lesson book. So, but there's a mention, and I thought it was on the right hand page at the top. But apparently, it's not, where it mentions Huldah. And that actually was a quote from here. Ah, here it is, up at the top of page 128. So the context is talking about Josiah. While he's still a very young man, on page 127, he determined to serve Jehovah. He destroyed the idols throughout the land. He gave orders that the temple be cleansed. In so doing, the workers found an ancient copy of the law of Moses. The king was terrified when he heard it read. Huldah the prophetess told him the law was correct. In other words, she was telling him that what he had read was he had a correct understanding of it, that they had been disobeying that law. And that God was as angry as the king feared. She said it was too late for the punishment to be averted, but that it would be postponed because of Josiah's faithfulness. So when it says here in 20 that who told Josiah that the law was correct, many of us thought that was kind of a strange statement last time. And I thought, well, it was Huldah, sure, but what do they mean by that? So that's exactly what we're talking about here, is a direct quote out of the lesson book itself. Now, I think we talked about this also. Josiah destroyed the high places of false gods that had been built. Oh, no, we hadn't. That's where I... Josiah destroyed the high places of false gods that had been built for what king's wives nearly 300 years earlier? Solomon, okay? Solomon had so many wives and concubines and such like. They were all from different lands and such as that. They had high places and places of worship for other gods just all over the place, apparently, according to this. So, yeah. And that's interesting here to note that was nearly 300 years before what we're talking about now. Randy?
I just want to mention one more thing about Huldah.
Huldah, yeah.
She said far more than the law's correct.
Yeah, she did.
She prophesied ultimate destruction of Jerusalem.
Exactly.
That's the next thing, too.
See, where is that? That's
2 Chronicles 34, beginning in verse 22.
22, okay, yeah. Yeah. So that's where they, in verse 22, it says they went to Huldah of the prophetess, and the, she actually says quite a bit there. And so it does talk about the prophecy of the destruction of Jerusalem. All of Judah, really. So, okay. Any other comment on that? Okay. And then this other question, the last question we have on that page. As Assyria was having its own troubles, Egypt strove for independence, and the Medes were growing in strength. Rebellions were coming upon the Assyrians from what city? That's the one. Yeah, Babylon. So, it you'll remember that earlier in the text, and I didn't look it up, the guy named, I think it's his name is Evil-Merodach or something like that. He was a king in Babylon, but that was before Babylon had any real strength. And so his name comes up and sort of disappears and such like as that. And I think it's possible, and I think we mention it here, they mention it here in the book, that he was the one that that the king in Israel asked for help from, and he decided he wasn't going to do it. Yeah. It's in there somewhere. But the Babylonian kingdom took a while to gain strength, and of course it did. I'm sure that the 185,000 Assyrians waking up dead didn't help help with the strength of the Assyrian army. So we'll need to remember that that was one thing that God brought upon them for their attack on Jerusalem. All right, so Babylon is now getting stronger. And as we go down here to question 23, a Chaldean prince named Nabopolassar managed to gain independence for Babylon. He joined forces with what people as they were laying siege to the city of Nineveh? It's actually in the previous question. Who joined forces with the Babylonians in order to defeat the Assyrians? The Medes. Okay? And then later on, whom do the Medes join up with to defeat the Babylonians? The Persians. Okay? So, so what we have, and I believe it's in the book that it mentions this, that the Babylonians, let me go back to this map here that we've got. Something a little bigger than 52.9%. All right, so the Babylonians, they sort of agreed with the Medes to a certain extent that the Medes would take this area up here and the Babylonians would keep this area down here. And so you note that this showing the Babylonian Empire coming right down to Egypt, part of the Sinai Peninsula here, though not being taken by the Babylonians. So apparently the Egyptians were able to hold on to their territory fairly well. You notice that these areas are not particularly long to get across as far as down here at the Red Sea and the Gulf of Suez. The Gulf of Aqaba, yeah, okay. So Aqaba and Suez here. So even though the Gulf of Suez is not particularly wide, you should note that in most of Old Testament history, or at least a lot of Old Testament history that we see, there is not a lot of sea warfare going on. In other words, people don't use boats a lot to make attacks on other people. Carolyn, you had your hand up, and then
You were pointing out that part of the Sinai Peninsula is still Egypt and not Babylon. I'm picturing your Google Earth image that shows what part of the Lower Nile, the Delta, is so green and I assume then populated. Would that be maybe because they've got more people there to defend it, and so they didn't fight? No, that doesn't matter. Just wondering.
Well, yeah, because They were down here, but I think your concept is probably good. In other words, they were able to put up a strong front along here.
Yeah, the part between the that was the second California popping league.
It is.
Yeah. The right-hand part of the delta, and then over to your pushpin. Is that sand?
It is. It's all sand.
Maybe they just didn't want it.
I wouldn't want it.
Who would fight for that?
Yeah, I know, exactly. This is the area when Linda and I and a couple of others of us were driving up to Israel, and we were driving along the Mediterranean here, and it's sand. It's all over sand dunes everywhere. And here's this guy with a camel, and it's blowing like crazy. He's got this big old long stick behind a camel. He's plowing a sand dune. I'm going, man. So, I mean, it just fills in right behind him. I'm not sure exactly what he was doing, but it was a
mirage.
I'm sure it was quite the jam. Maybe that's what it was. Addled by that. Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Sand blowing in his eyes, and he's got a camel with a stick. So.
And as soon as we got over the border into Israel, it was like, whew, grass and green.
Yeah.
So it is a really stark contrast.
It's just amazing. I mean, you can, if we zoomed in on this some more, you could see the line between Egypt and Israel. It's in the sand. When we talk about a line in the sand, it's there. I mean, we approach the Israeli border, and there's flowers, and there's trees, and there's houses that don't look like they've been built 300 years ago and haven't been taken care of since then, and such a like as that. And, if I zoomed in on this area right here, we'd see it. And you can see a little bit of it here, but we're up to.
We're saying plant mountain honey, you know, because it is.
But it's because the Israelis realized that they can harness the desert, whereas the Egyptians couldn't care less. They've got this area right here, and that's all they care about. So, anyway, right. What was I talking about? I don't remember now.
Oh, you were showing what part Babylon controlled.
Oh, yeah. So Babylon came down and used this area right here. And this does look a whole lot more sandy than this one. This has got some topography to it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it's got mountains and things like that. And there's, you know, if we zoomed in a little more, we could see the random area of greenery here and there. But that's about it. Yeah. Stream, right. They went to the push pin and that was it. They ran right into it and quit.
Ow.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. We were looking at this. Nabopolassar laid siege with the Medes. Okay. So, Josiah. What is this? What's Josiah doing going up to Megiddo and fighting people? Why did he do that? Josiah was a really good king, right? He did all sorts of neat things for Israel, brought them back to the Lord as far as he could, you know, without, beating them all senseless. But, but he goes up to Megiddo and gets killed. By whom does he get killed?
Pharaoh
Necho of Egypt, of all places they have down here. Yeah, Pharaoh Necho of Egypt. Yeah. But
it was almost like he was a bully pushing him, really. Because didn't Nico say something? I really don't have an argument with you, but you keep coming.
That's right. Nico warned him off, and as a matter of fact, he said, what he said is, "I'm on a mission from God." And what was Pharaoh Necho doing at this time? They eventually went up to Carchemish. And what was he doing? He was joining together, I think it was at that time, with some of the local peoples to fight against Babylon, as I recall, is what it was. Let me see if we... Josiah was... There we go. It's in the, I don't know, bottom third of page 128. let's see. Okay, so... Here, right where it's in the middle of the page of 128, where it says "label the Medes territory," it's talking above that about Nabopolassar managed to gain independence for Babylon. He joined forces with the Medes. They laid siege to the city of Nineveh. It fell after only 3 months, never to rise again in 612 BC. Another decisive battle at Carchemish marked Assyria's final downfall. Josiah was reigning in Judah during these last years of Assyria's struggles. All troops had to be pulled from the provinces to try to protect Nineveh, so Judah was free by default. Josiah was able to take at least nominal control of most of the land of Canaan. Archaeologists say the city of Megiddo came under his control and was restored as administrative headquarters for control of the northern section of Israel. Then down two paragraphs says, Egypt was also rejoicing over the fall of Assyria, but they saw an increasing danger in the Babylonians. It would be to Egypt's advantage if a weakened but still existing Assyrian empire, or Assyrian, still existing Assyrian, looks like they're missing, yeah, remained between Egypt and Babylon. Assyrian troops continued to fall back after Nineveh fell. Pharaoh Necho of Egypt decided to rush north along the way of the sea and help Assyria. So they go up, so the probably rather formidable army of Egypt goes up along the sea way, along, is kind of ignoring Israel as they go by because they're just kind of penned up over there in the city of Jerusalem, that's about it, and have nominal control of the rest of the country. And they go rushing up there to try and help the Assyrians to overcome the Babylonians because apparently Pharaoh Necho felt that it was better to work with somebody, to hate somebody that he knew, rather than to have to learn to hate somebody else. So he was going to go up and help the Assyrians, and Josiah decides, well, while the Egyptians are here, I might as well fight them. You go, are you kidding me? Once again, this strikes me as being the yappy dog syndrome. We're just a little bunch of people, and we're going to go up and we're going to nip at the heels of the bear. And then when he turns around to get us, we're not going to run away. Randy?
I think what we can learn by what's not written is when Josiah was sent a message in 2 Chronicles 35, Necho, verse 21, Necho sent messengers to him saying, what have we to do with each other, O king of Judah? I'm not coming against you today, but against the house with which I am at war. God has ordered me to hurry. Stop for your own sake from interfering with God who is with me, so that he will not destroy you. So here's Necho calling on the name of the God of Israel.
Right.
And saying, your God has told me to go to this place. Why are you trying to interfere with him?
Exactly.
And if you keep interfering with him, he's going to destroy you.
Right.
And then it says, however, Josiah would not turn away from him, but disguised himself in order to make war with him, nor did he listen to the words of Necho from the mouth of God. So here's God using an enemy of God's people as a prophet.
Yes, exactly.
He's using him as a mouthpiece.
Right.
To tell Josiah, get out of the way. I've got business here, and this has nothing to do with you.
Right.
I think the reason Josiah was killed was because he didn't inquire for it. He didn't, it's not listed anywhere in here that he inquired the Lord and said, is this really going on? Are you sending him up? Should I stay away from this? Should I go to war with him? What should I do here? He didn't inquire the Lord. He didn't send one of his prophets to inquire the Lord.
Yeah.
He just thought, oh, the war's with me, so I'll go up against Egypt and we'll win.
Exactly. Right. Oops. Right. Yeah. Juan, what is it that that God said about the king of Babylon? He called him his what?
His servant.
His servant. So later on, when we're looking at the book of Daniel, I think it is, we see that in about three areas in the book of Daniel, the king of Babylon is called God's servant. And once again, even though you might think that right here that Necho is boasting, right down here the word of God says, he hearkened not unto the words of Necho from the mouth of God. So God himself says, these words are from me. I sent Necho up here to do this. You quit messing with him. And Josiah says, well, I'm a little yappy dog. This is what I do. I'm going to go bite his heels. And so what happens to Josiah? He died suddenly with an arrow. Yes.
He'd been disguised.
And was he disguised?
Yes.
The archers. Well, I know in the other battle where Ahab and
22.
Okay. Oh, but disguised himself. Okay. All right. It sounded much like the similar one between Ahab and the other king, where he's what? Where yeah? Where he says, "I'll wear my disguise, and you wear your kingly garments. And when they come after you, then yeah."
God won't recognize us. He won't know where we are.
That's right. All right. So Nico warns him off, and the guy says, "Well, whatever. We're going to attack anyway." So they do, and Josiah gets shot. And so they put him in his standby chariot, and took him back to Jerusalem, where he died, and they buried him in the sepulchres of his father, and they mourned for him. And it says here that Jeremiah lamented for Josiah. Once again, Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, as it were. Zach's first and last, behold, are written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah. And now we come to good King Jehoahaz, right? Yeah, no. Let's actually go back to the questions here. All right. So Josiah was killed at Megiddo when he met with what individual? How is Megiddo referred to peripherally today? Armageddon. So you see that a lot of people are talk about Armageddon, you know, and it's actually a compound Hebrew word, Har Megiddo, which simply means the mountain of Megiddo. And so it is the valley of, what is it, Esdraelon or whatever, that's down there below the mountain. And it's interesting to note when you read through the book of Revelation and look at the discussion about Megiddo and the battle that will take place there, it doesn't last very long. It says the armies are going to gather themselves together, but then nothing happens. God wins immediately, if not sooner. Lynn, did you have your hand up? Okay. All right. Babylon and who agreed to coexist with each other? I think we've already talked about that. Who was that? Media, right. And who claimed all of Mesopotamia, Syria, Palestine, Arabia, and Egypt? Now. You know, this is another one of those, well, all I have to do is read the questions around it. Oh, Babylon claimed all of Mesopotamia, Syria, Palestine, Arabia, and Egypt. Not all of Egypt. We saw what the extent of their kingdom was there in that map on the new... what page is that on? That's page 136 in your book. All right, then, who is the ruler in Babylon when the first group of captives, and notice he says, including Daniel, was taken from Judah? Who was that king?
Nebuchadnezzar.
And we see a lot of discussion about Nebuchadnezzar in the Old Testament. As a matter of fact, what is it, probably half of the book of Daniel has to do with King Nebuchadnezzar. Then we go on to the other folks after that. And I think by the end of the book of Daniel, we're talking about Cyrus, as I recall.
Darius the Mede. Darius the Mede's in there, too.
Was Darius first, or Cyrus was first, right? And then... Okay. I forget which one is which. But, well... Yeah, Belshazzar is... He was the one that was there, I think, when the Medes and the Persians came in to take over, right?
Yes, because they had the handwriting on the wall.
Yeah.
I remember Daniel was not meant to be in consecutive order. Oh. Chapters
are not okay. Well, we'll figure out one of these days. So we realized that we had Cyrus. I'm pretty sure that it's Cyrus because Cyrus is the one that's mentioned by name in prophecy. So we would expect, I think, Cyrus to probably be the first one. And then probably Darius came after him, and then Belshazzar was the one that was in power when the Medes and the Persians came and took over. And there may have been other people in between that time. And I'm pretty sure that when we talk about the handwriting on the wall, it mentions... it's Daniel, right? Daniel mentions that Nebuchadnezzar was this guy's dad, I think, or maybe his grandfather. I think it's his father that mentions that. All right. Ruler of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, right. 28. Who took away all the treasures from the temple and from the palace of Judah? I mean, the Babylonians, yeah. I mean, they just won, right? So, Babylonian army took all those things away. Now, here's a good one that Linda spent about 15 minutes trying to get me the answer for. After about 10 years after the first captives were taken, Zedekiah was set up as a puppet king over the remnant of Israel. At that time, who was taken captive?
I just said the rest of the people.
The rest of the people will be the proper answer, but actually what we're looking for is a single person. And it's not, pardon? No. It's not found in the text of this chapter. It's a reference back to the list of the kings, as they mentioned in like the first paragraph of this lesson. If you go back to the list of kings,
it's on page
117. It's right where the page number 590 or the year number 597 is. Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem. Jehoiachin and his officials surrendered and went out to the king. He and 10,000 craftsmen of Judah were deported to Babylon. Ezekiel, the prophet, is taken. Go. All right.
So, yeah, well, technically, I would say that Jehoiachin and the 10,000 craftsmen and Ezekiel would be the correct answer.
Yes, that's right. That's like more like Lynn said, it's like the rest of the people and Ezekiel. So... you notice over in the next column about prophets, where it talks about them, it says Ezekiel, the prophet to the common Jew in Babylonian captivity. And I think that's where they're taking their instance from. So if we look at Ezekiel, we understand that he's prophesying while they are still captive in Babylon, in the Babylonian Empire. I think if we look up Ezekiel and look up the name of the prophet, we're not going to find his name mentioned here. As far as the prophet Ezekiel goes in the book of Second Chronicles. Who was God's spokesman during the time when the Babylonians were conquering Judah? When they were conquering Judah, not after they had been conquered. So we'd been talking about him already.
Jeremiah.
Yeah, he was the prophet that was talking about the folks in Judah. Oh, Babylon leveled Jerusalem in what year? 586. What was the first year that they started taking people away?
606.
I think it was 606. Wasn't it?
That's the mark of the beginning of the 7th year.
Right. And that's, I think, as he says, that's when Daniel was taken away and so on. And I think that's what they're saying, that Ezekiel was taken away at that time also. Though I'm not positive about the time frame here. But no, that would have been a different time. But anyway, so the first deportation was at 606. And then 586, which is 20 years later, right? Right. So, yeah, and there's a mention, and I forgot to look it up, I just thought of it now. There's a mention of the 50 years in the text of the Bible, of the Old Testament here somewhere. And so, I'll have to look that up again. But there was a mention about the 50 years. And so, we understand that that has to do with the difference between the 606 and the 586, which is a 20-year period. But yes, they were prophesied to stay in Babylonian captivity for 70 years. And so they did. And as a matter of fact, when we get to the book of Ezra, we see indeed that it's talking about they're released from captivity, and it gives years, dates, as it were, of in I just almost said Nebuchadnezzar's reign, but I don't think it's Nebuchadnezzar's reign. So, but the when they were coming out. Let me look on Ezra real quick here. So I shouldn't have to go that far. Artaxerxes is and the, so Cyrus makes the proclamation that they can leave, and then they return from Babylon, and it says in the first chapter, in the first verse of Ezra, now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Jehovah by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout his kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, and they, that's where he released the Jews to go back to their towns. We need to ring the first bell, such as it is. Another thing we need to get fixed is the bell. all right, so Babylon came in and completely destroyed Jerusalem in 586, leveled the city, burnt the temple, all of this sort of stuff. By that time, they had already conquered and destroyed all of the fortified cities in Judah anyway. So Jerusalem essentially was just the last thing. They were just a vassal. They were just hanging on by a thread at that time. They were governed by governor Gedaliah that had been appointed by the king, and so there wasn't much left of them by the time that Babylon came down, leveled Jerusalem. Who was set up as a puppet governor? I believe I just mentioned his name. So, and who urged the small group of Israelites who were left to remain in the land instead of fleeing to Egypt? That was Jeremiah. Jeremiah urged them quite a bit.
42:19.
I think so. Okay. Well, that must be Kings then, right? No.
No.
There is no 40.
22.
Huh?
Jeremiah.
Oh, Jeremiah. Of course. are we sure we got 42 verses and chapters and Chronicles? Okay. So in Jeremiah 42, Jeremiah prophesies about the fact that they should not go down to Egypt. It's not a good thing. They were told many times not to join themselves with Egypt. They went down there, and all they had was bad luck, as it were, down there, because God did not bless them while they were down in Egypt. All right. So Jeremiah did that, and starting when Daniel was taken captive, what prophesied event began for Judah?
70.
The 70 years of captivity. Okay. So it had been prophesied that they would be in captivity for 70 years. And when Daniel and those folks, when Ezekiel was taken captive, that's when that 70 years started. Okay. We didn't get into at all this review of the divided kingdom called Lesson 32 in our books. It would be a good thing to go through because it just gives us a quick review of what's going on. excuse me. Wow. I think I was building a car here. All right. So we've only got a couple of minutes here, but you can see that as we go through this, the idea here is that we're going to answer either Israel or Judah. So it's just incredibly obvious most of the time which is which. So Samaria was the capital of what? Come on, work. All right. For some reason, there we go. Samaria was the capital of what?
Israel.
Okay. So it's a 50-50 chance here. So we've got Jerusalem was the capital of?
Judah.
Judah, yeah, go figure. All right. Which one, however, had more tribes? Israel did. How many did they have? Yeah, they had 10. And Judah had which two? Judah, yeah, and another one. Right. Who controlled Moab at least part of the time?
Israel.
Yeah, that's Israel. Yeah. Who controlled Edom at least part of the time? Judah, yeah. So, who had a descendant of David on the throne all the time? That would be Judah, okay. There were no descendants of David in Israel at all. Okay. Which one became wicked faster? That's not to say that they weren't both wicked.
Israel,
that's right. All right. And who had continual conflicts with Syria? Israel, because why? They're closer. Yeah. Generally speaking, that's the reason why these things happen. Well, who's closest? I'll pick on him. Yeah. All right. Let's finish off lesson 32 on whatever the next class day is, Wednesday. And we'll perhaps go into the captivity at that time also.